Accession number 4431, reel number 4.
Mr. Wallach, tape 4. Could you tell me, sir, going back to your life in the camps, Camp L and Camp N in Canada, could you describe what sort of social activities went on?
We played a great deal of bridge. We had a couple of international bridge players, Austrian in particular, a man called Feuerbach, who played it brilliantly, Victor Rosenfeld, now Victor Ross, and European manager for the Reader's Digest, was another outstanding bridge player, and so was Hans Netter. We played chess, we read a great deal, and we gave lectures to each other. There were camp concerts. We had an excellent pianist called Bloomer. I think he was professional standing. One or two reasonable violinists. And apart from that, there was no social life. We certainly never saw any Canadians except the camp staff and the military. As I mentioned, Prince Friedrich was occasionally allowed out to parties of Colonel Wiggs, but not otherwise. In fact, so totally were we cut off that though we had one of the two experts on the city of Quebec in the world in our camp among the students, who was writing a thesis on the city of Quebec, there he was stuck on the Heights of Abraham. He could not get at Quebec. He was not allowed to communicate with the only other expert who was living in the city of Quebec, nor could he get at the libraries there. One of his great frustrations, that the chance of a lifetime of actually getting across the Atlantic, which in those days was much less of a regular occurrence than it is today, of course, there he was at last, near the place he was researching, and he couldn't get at it. He was as far away from it as ever he had been in Cambridge. So no fraternizing of any kind at all.
You didn't have any visits from various groups, Canadian groups?
Apart from the aide de camp of the Governor General, we never had any visits from anybody, as far as I can recall, no.
Did you... Were you able to communicate with your family?
Yes, we were allowed letters by this time. Letters to MPs were almost unlimited, although again this quarrel about writing on prisoner of war notepaper played its part, but we accepted that we had to. It wasn't only that it was prisoner of war notepaper headed prisoner of war, but it was only one sheet of foolscap paper, so you couldn't write a great deal on it. But we were allowed, I forget now how many letters, I think it was in the end, it was two letters a week. And I certainly communicated freely with my family. You were allowed to receive as many letters as you wanted, or as many letters as were sent to you. And indeed, later on, magazines came in from all over the world. They were accepted and admitted. And I had a brother who was then studying at Harvard, and my mother lived in the United States, and I had a sister in South America, in Argentina, married there, and with them I corresponded as freely as I could. That is to say, I wrote my two weekly letters, distributed them as fairly as I could, and received as many letters from them as they were prepared to write, which was very many, I'm glad to say. So they're really the... handicaps and restrictions were not very great. Many people might have wanted to write more than two letters a week, but I don't think there are all that many people who write letters to a large extent.
So your family think that were out of Germany?
They were all out of Germany. My brother and my sister had both left Germany. My brother, after studying for a year at Munich, had gone for a year to Oxford, where he studied at Balliol College. He then served an apprenticeship as a banker. He was meant to take over his father's firm, first in South America, then in North America. And then during the war, in order to have a an academic qualification. He went to Harvard, where he got his PhD, his Master of Arts, and later his PhD, and was doing that at the time when I was interned. He is now a member of the board of the Federal Reserve in the United States. My sister married in South America with a German who followed her out there when she emigrated. They had four children. They are both now dead. He was a farmer, and the children are now well established, think of themselves as Argentinians, indeed, as my brother's children think of themselves entirely as Americans. Basically, the family might have arranged things better had they thought in terms of emigration at all at the time in the 30s. They thought that the Hitler period would be a short one, that their children were going abroad temporarily to wherever it was most suitable for them to go, and that they would all one day, when Hitler had finished his work, be returning to Germany and be reunited there. Had they thought initially in terms of emigration, they might have arranged things so that we would all have been in the same country, but it did not at that time occur to them. And by the time 1939, when things became clear, or 1938, when it became perfectly clear that the Jews were going to have a very thin time of it indeed in Germany, it was too late. My father decided that he could not face emigration. He committed suicide. My mother came from Germany to visit me and my brother in 1939, still refusing to believe that there would be a war. We persuaded her to come over for a visit, as it seemed to her, and I put her on a ship from Liverpool to the United States late in August 1939. War broke out while she was on the high seas. She got to America, and she stayed there and has remained there ever since.
And were you able to follow the course of the war while you were interned in Canada? Did you know what battles were taking place and how the war was going?
Yes, we did. But somewhat behind time. We did not get newspapers, if I remember rightly, until rather later. We started off by having comparatively little communication. These things all settled down gradually. I think the camp office played a considerable part under Prince Frederick in getting conditions there improved, so that as time went by, we had daily papers delivered to us, could buy them. We had a canteen established where we could buy sweets initially and cigarettes rather later. The cigarette problem remained with us for many, many weeks. Later on, we were even allowed to order through the canteen consumer goods such as bits of machinery, clothing, whatever we wanted. I don't think we were allowed wireless sets. I can't recall. But I don't think we were allowed wireless sets. We would have known about that.
I was wondering, when you mentioned the weather, you know, your camp in, how cold it was, were you able to buy warm clothes, or did they supply you with warm clothing?
We were allowed to get warm clothes by the time we got to Camp N. They also supplied us, and we were allowed to have parcels sent with them. So by that time, we really had very considerable freedom to purchase and to have things sent to us, and we suffered no hardship of that kind at all. I think the early days of our Canadian camp certainly were very short on a number of goods. Certainly cigarettes were desperately short, I recall, because on his sallies to the officers' mess of the camp commandant, Prince Frederick used to collect the cigarette butts for us to turn into proper cigarettes, and people surreptitiously watched the windows outside the camp intelligence officer's hut. The camp intelligence officer spent much time actually in the camp, which none of the other officers did, and he would from time to time throw a cigarette butt out of the window, and this was pounced upon immediately by somebody who put it into a small tin, gathered it together, and these cigarette butts were unashamedly sold by people, and there were plenty to buy them.
This camp intelligence officer, he was about a lot, you say. Were there people you suspected in the camp of being informers or...
Oh, yes. Mm. Oh, there was a great deal of intrigue, and everybody had their theories as to what went on there. The group of internee administrators themselves, who to a certain extent worked to the intelligence officer, who supplied him with lists of people he asked for, frequently professional lists, lists of one kind or another, confessional lists, who were the Protestants, who were the Jews, and so on, how many were there, statistics largely. They were very much suspected by those who were not in that group of passing to the intelligence officer all sorts of their own views and news on what was going on in the camp. In fact, as far as I recall, nothing of that kind went on. But there was a great deal of suspicion, as there always is in these circumstances, yes.
You mentioned earlier on about the food, that you had very good food at Camp L. Did this continue at your other camp?
Yes, we were entirely on army rations. The Canadians regarded us by status as prisoners of war. And under the Geneva conventions, I believe that prisoners of war have got to be given the equivalent rations of food as the army, the domestic army. So we got Canadian army rations, and this was out of this world for people who were doing no physical effort. Fortunately, later on, with a bit of sports equipment and what we fixed up for ourselves, a great deal of volleyball was being played, and so we got rid of some of our energy that way. But we ate far more than we needed, and certainly far more than we were likely to get again when we got back to England.
And was there any provision for kosher food in the proper kosher kitchen?
Yes, they had kosher cooking. Whether the food which was originally delivered was kosher, I very much doubt. I think they all got army rations, but they were at least able to... there was plenty of food to allow them to do without bacon, for instance, or pork. And the cooking, there was provision for kosher cooking. There was not indeed a very great need for it. We had the group of Orthodox Jews was not large in our camp.
How did you manage for money? You were saying that you were able to buy consumer goods and such like later on. Did you have a weekly allowance in the camp?
Do you know, I can't remember.
No.
I simply can't remember how we had money, but how we got money and where we got it from, I can't recall now. Simply, it slipped my mind completely that.
Can you remember your own mental state during these months in Canada? How
I
you
did
felt?
A great deal. I did a great deal of reading. I was notorious for writing my diary every day, and I wish I had this still somewhere around. I think I have probably, but I can't find it at the moment. Put on paper a great deal of what I was reading, analyzing it, criticizing it. I think I suffered, if at all, from a lack of real intellectual stimulus. Though we were all there taking in each other's intellectual washing, as I keep on calling it, this was not the kind of stimulus you needed, because it was all in vacuo. It was an abstract exercise which could keep you entertained like a game for a while, but it had nothing concrete to bite upon. And this was a lack which one felt quite strongly, that whatever we did and thought would have no effect. There were no decisions which we could take. All the decisions were being taken for us. And we were therefore a totally artificial society, thinking artificially, acting artificially, with no, in no real context.
Were you anxious at all about your family?
Basically not, because both my brother and my mother were in the United States, where they were not in any danger. My sister was in the Argentine, where she was even in less danger. I had no relatives, no very close relatives left in Germany.
Had you a girlfriend in England, or anyone close
to you? I had a girlfriend in England with whom I corresponded, and that was a great help and very pleasant, and she wrote very regularly, and I wrote regularly. Yes, that kept the contact alive very much with England. Again, no, I didn't feel at any time, or indeed when I was in England, I never felt that I was in any physical danger. I think, as many of us did, okay, a bomb might hit you, but the chances were very much against it. I mean, many people were killed in Britain, but many more stayed alive.
Yes. Of course, you were still very young.
Yes,
you were still 21. How do you think you compared with older people in the camp, your mental attitude?
No, I think we were very callow. We did not really see the problems which existed for the older people. We were apt to be contemptuous of their worries and not take them sufficiently seriously. We made no allowances, being young, for the problems which the older generation faced in having lost their jobs, in their families being in Britain and frequently unable to earn any money, not knowing where their next penny or meal was coming from. All these things we fortunately were not in a position to have to worry about, but they were. And the only redeeming grace there which I can think of is basically that in the Canadian camps, at any rate, most of us were in the same boat, and there weren't very many of the elderly people or middle-aged people with family responsibilities around.
So if we go back to your arrival back in Britain, you arrived back still as an internee, I gather.
Yes, very much so, in Liverpool. And the first thing that met us, or that we saw on the quayside, was a detachment of soldiers with bayonets fixed, awaiting coming down the gangplank, at which Captain Powell cut up rough and said, "I'm not going to have this. These young people have, on the whole, all of them, done very well in bringing this ship into port. They've helped. They have behaved perfectly well. I understood that they were going to be released when they got here, and I'm not going to have them escorted as if they were major criminals and dangerous." So he had a parley with the commanding officer of the detachment, who ordered his troops to unfix their bayonets, at any rate, and to be a little less prominent and obvious in escorting us. We were taken off the ship and back to Huyton. And in Huyton we then stayed. We knew our release was just a matter of time. People were being released every day. It was a total interregnum, we felt, and so it turned out. I found myself in the administrative hut or office, signing a document saying that I was joining up. I swore the oath of allegiance, which one swears on joining the army, or did in those days, and I was then allowed a week's holiday to settle my affairs before going to my unit in Ilfracombe.
What were you going to join?
The Pioneer Corps, as everybody had to join the Pioneer Corps. any alien. And
were you encouraged into joining this?
No, I think it was quite simply a matter could either stay interned if you wanted to, or you could try to get out on some other grounds, which were grounds for release, or you could, if you felt that there weren't any other valid grounds, you could say, well, I prefer to join the army rather than stay in internment. Many people preferred to stay in internment and stayed there. And I decided I didn't. I wanted to get back and join the army, therefore. But you had to sign up before they released you, as it were. Then you were released. I was released. I went back to Cambridge and went back to my lodgings where I had lived, and which I had kept on during this time by banker's order, having checks sent monthly to my landlady, Mrs. Key. Found my room in apple pie order, everything where it had been when I left it, and she, having received a postcard from me expecting me and welcoming me warmly, when I opened my writing table drawers, I found that they were empty, no papers. Including everything my research, which I had done for a year between 1939 and 1940 on Anglo-German relations between 1870 and 1914. So I asked Mrs. Key what had happened to the papers, and she said, well, you know, when the police came to collect you, I wondered whether they'd be back, and I knew you'd been writing a lot and you'd got a lot of papers. If they came, and if they searched that room, they found something compromising, and in the end they might even hang you. I said, do something about that. So she took all my papers and burnt them. She said it took her 3 days in her boiler to burn the lot. And I felt so touched that I hadn't the heart to tell her, A, that she'd made herself an accessory after the fact if I really had been a spy, and B, that she destroyed a year's research. But at any rate, it had the advantage that whatever doubts I might have had whether to get myself released on grounds of academic distinction or the army had been sensibly resolved in the right way, I wouldn't have wanted to start again where I'd started more than a year ago. And so I went into the Pioneer Corps with a very easy mind.
So what date were you released?
Sometime in January 1900, it must have been the end of January or beginning February 1941, joined the Pioneer Corps in Ilfracombe in the same month, either February or late January, I think it must have been early February, and after a period of training in the Pioneer Corps, which to me, having served in the OTC at school, was rather old hat. You learnt nothing but marching and shouldering arms and so on. I was transferred to a regular Pioneer Corps company in Catterick, 248 Company.
And how long were you in the Pioneer Corps?
For about a year and a half before my application to join the Royal Artillery was ratified, and I then went to join an artillery unit in Devizes, and they sent me to an artillery octu back to Catterick, and from there I was commissioned into field artillery, first 185 Regiment and then 191 Field Regiment, with whom I went to France and was in the North European campaign.
When you look back on internment, did it strain your faith in British democracy at all?
It strained my faith in British competence, certainly. But then I don't know that it ever was very great in the first place. No, in British democracy, not. It was quite clearly a muddle. It turned out that if you wrote to your MP, if you lobbied your MP would lobby the government, and gradually things would be done. It never occurred to me that this was in any way something directed against us personally or as a group, but that it was something which happened at a time of considerable strain and stress to the British government. Why on earth they thought they had to impose upon themselves even worse horrors by interning so many Jews, especially so many articulate Jews, I cannot imagine, but they did it, and I think they suffered for it.
Do you think you missed anything by being interned?
Yes, I probably did. I missed a university career. I think had I stayed at Cambridge, had I been called up into the army, I would have returned to Cambridge after that and would probably have become a don. Whether I'd done any better at that than I have in my profession, I don't know. Sometimes I regret not having done it, especially when I'm up in Cambridge. But on the whole, no, I think not.
Do you think you gained anything?
Yes, I've gained a lot of experience of human frailties, of human behaviour and the stress. I met a large number of interesting and enjoyable people, with many of whom I'm still in touch. And as an experience, it was undoubtedly extremely valuable, though perhaps not so intended either by the government or me.
Could I ask you, please, you didn't follow up your donnish career. What did you actually do?
I went into broadcasting. I became a producer of current affairs programmes and have just retired from that job.
Mr. Wallach, thank you very much indeed.